Hello and welcome to this episode of DebtWired. I'm Hossein Dabiri, head of court reporting for EMEA at DebtWire Europe. And in this episode of DebtWired, we will be talking about the role of the English court's discretion when sanctioning a restructuring plan proposed under Part 26A of the Companies Act 2006 and exercising its so-called cram-down jurisdiction. My guests today are two distinguished specialists in the restructuring and insolvency space, one coming from the world of practice at the bar, while the other comes from the academia. Georgina Peters, my first guest, is a barrister from South Square, the leading chamber in London when it comes to presenting Part 26A restructuring plans before the High Court. Georgina is one of the most active South Square barristers when it comes to plans and schemes of arrangement, having been involved in many recent major cases such as Aggregate Holding and Fitness First. My second guest is Sarah Patterson, who is a professor of law at London School of Economics and Political Science, or LSE. Her main areas of research are corporate reorganization and insolvency. She is also a former partner at Slaughter & May's London office. Since their introduction into the English debt restructuring toolbox in June 2020, Part 26A plans have become an increasingly popular option for debt issuers seeking to address their liabilities in a speedy, efficient, and reliable way. And one key feature of this robust process is the cross-class cram-down feature. Today, we're going to take a close look at the role of the court's discretion when sanctioning these plans while exercising the cross-class cram-down powers. There has been some criticism in recent plans about the lack of engagement with certain creditors before launching plans. Sarah, how does this fit into the statutory architecture of Part 26A?
Thank you, Hussein. Very kind introduction. The purpose of Part 26A is to sanction a compromise or arrangement. And this, we can go back a long way. In the scheme case of NFU Development Trust, Brightman, who had considered a 19th century case, Alabama Railway, said that the word compromise implied some element of accommodation on each side. It wasn't apt to describe what he called total surrender. So a claimant who abandons his claim isn't compromising it. And similarly, the word arrangement in the section implies some element of give and take. So after Adler, we know that this interpretation of the statutory language also applies to Part 26A. But what I want to suggest here is that these words, compromise and arrangement, are freighted with a much deeper meaning, and that is what provides the conceptual basis for cram-down in English law's restructuring tools. That dissenting creditors are refusing a fair commercial bargain that they ought to be willing to accept. So that leads me in my academic work to suggest that the company should be able to show that it's attempted to bargain, but those efforts have failed. So in using the cross-class cram-down power, in asking the court to resort to that power, they ought to be able to show that bargaining efforts have failed. So this is what an economist would call a market failure that justifies the use of the cram-down tool. We don't have time today to go through why bargaining is so difficult in restructuring, but it is. And that raises questions about recent cases in which the debtor offers no evidence of any attempt to bargain at all. So, for example, in Fitness First, at paragraph 27 of his judgment, we are told by the judge, even though the company had clearly decided by January 2023, and indeed, Teneo had been instructed by May 2022 to prepare for a restructuring, there was no engagement with landlord creditors until the practice statement letter was sent to all creditors on the 17th of April 2023. So the first issue that I really want to raise for us today is whether the court should expect to see some evidence of bargaining before it exercises the cross-class cram-down jurisdiction.
Let's take a look at how this has played out in practice. Georgina, how, in your experience, have the courts reacted to a perceived lack of engagement with creditors?
Hossein, you very kindly used the word perceived lack of engagement, given that I was acting for the company in the Fitness First case to which Sarah's just referred. I think the first thing I'd say is that this issue has only really come into focus in those plans which involve both a financial and operational restructuring, rather than where the company is negotiating with a limited group of sophisticated financial creditors. Now, in financial restructurings, it's typically the case that the dissentient creditors have been involved in the detailed negotiations. It's simply that they just haven't liked the end result. And now it is right that in Fitness First, as Sarah said, and in the case of Prezzo, which were two plans where the convening hearings were held broadly around the same time and where I acted for the company, the judge at the convening hearing, who was the same judge in both those cases, Mr. Justice Zaccaroli, sounded a warning about the lack of prior engagement with landlords and property creditors. And of course, in Virgin Active, where I had acted for the dissenting creditors, the landlords complained that there hadn't been any meaningful engagement with landlord creditors. However, in both Fitness First and Virgin Active, both judges, when it came to the sanction hearing, took what they described, in the words of Mr. Justice Michael Green, as a be that as it may approach. He said in particular that whilst he had sympathy with the complaints, the lack of engagement ultimately did not affect the substantive decision that he had to make about whether to approve the plan. So there hasn't yet been a case where the lack of engagement has been substantively considered when the court decides whether to exercise the cram-down power. But Sarah, I do agree with you that the term compromise or arrangement might be argued on one view to connote a process of engagement and, where possible, bargaining. Whether it does or it doesn't, I think that that term has both a procedural and substantive element when it comes to bargaining. In terms of process, and leaving aside for one moment what the meaning of the term compromise or arrangement might be argued to be, I think the court is more likely to exercise its cram-down power where it can be demonstrated that the company has made efforts to engage and, where there is scope to do so, negotiate, and that the company has done so on the basis of providing full information to creditors. Then, as to the substantive element, it's also going to be much easier for the company to demonstrate that this is the only deal which the assenting creditors will accept if there has been this process of engagement and negotiation. And now we saw that very clearly in the aggregate case, where the dissentient creditors' arguments that the relevant alternative was a different deal simply fell apart, because it became clear that there had been long and complex negotiations, which the assenting creditors, who I acted for, had approached with, in the judge's words, an open mind. Now, in that case, the challenging creditor had actually rejected a prior offer in much earlier negotiations, which, as time went on, turned out to be better than the outcome under the plan. So not a very promising start. So whilst I'm not sure we can go so far as to say that the court will not exercise its cram-down power without a process of bargaining, it's certainly highly relevant from both procedural and substantive viewpoints. So Sarah, if you're right that bargaining is a central concept under Part 26A, what implications would you say this has for the fair division of the benefits of the plan?
Thanks, Georgina. So I think my bargaining framework assumes that the assenting classes would be willing to share some of the benefits they gain under the plan with the dissenting classes. So the compromise or arrangement that the legislation envisages. So the bargaining framework explains why we wouldn't expect to see a plan in which a dissenting class gains nothing from it. And it really opens up, I think, what happened in aggregate for discussion. So just quoting from that again, the judge said the plan company did not engage with the detail of the dissenting creditors' complaints by seeking to explain why the allocation of benefits was fair. Rather, the plan company argues that since the subordinated creditors would be out of the money on the relevant alternative, they had no entitlement to share in the benefits of the restructuring, with the result that it was none of their concern how the senior creditors chose to share those benefits among themselves or with others. So in my current academic work, and I hope to have a paper which I will be publishing on SSRM very shortly, I'm going to suggest that the plan company should explain why the allocation of the benefits under the plan is fair. Specifically, the plan company should be able to articulate why the dissenting classes are being offered a fair division of the benefits of the plan, so that it would be commercially reasonable for them to accept it. And that should be more than the fact that the dissenting class is no worse off than they would be if the company were to be placed into an insolvency process and its business and assets or assets sold. So the reason for this is that we're assuming that the assenting class is better off than they would be in that scenario. And we would expect them, therefore, in a bargaining scenario, to be willing to share some of the benefits that they are going to gain in return for avoiding the insolvency scenario. In short, the point cuts both ways. The dissenting class should not be able to say that they should gain all the benefit up to the amount that the assenting class would gain in an insolvency process on the basis that the assenting class would avoid insolvency at all costs. That clearly doesn't solve a bargaining problem. The assenting class isn't going to agree to give all of its benefit to the dissenting class. Instead, the dissenting class has to be able to explain what share of the benefits they think they should be allocated and why they think the current plan doesn't share those benefits in a commercially reasonable way. So the second issue I'd like to raise is whether it is right that plan companies can continue to come to court running the argument that the dissenting class is what we would call out of the money in the event of an insolvent sale of the business or assets, and therefore has no entitlement to share in the benefits of the restructuring, other than a nominal amount to meet what becomes a purely technical requirement for a compromise or arrangement, or whether there's substance to the compromise or arrangement point, so that the assenting class must offer the dissenting class a commercially reasonable share of the benefits of the plan and must positively explain why it considers that the allocation of benefits that it proposes is fair. However, Georgina, I think rather inevitably you have some questions about how this might actually work in practice.
That's absolutely right, Sarah, I do. Before I go there, I think it might be helpful to pause for a moment and just remind ourselves of what we know from the cases so far. From the cases, it's clear that two propositions have been accepted by the courts to date. The first is that the courts have consistently recognised that allocation of value is an issue which they have to address when deciding whether to impose a plan on a dissenting class. And the Court of Appeal in Adler has now confirmed that. So I think the requirement for the company to demonstrate fair allocation of value has always been there. And in fact, we saw that as early on as Deep Ocean. The second proposition is that the Court of Appeal has also now made clear in Adler that in considering fair allocation of value, the court is required to consider whether a different allocation would have been possible. Now, I use the word different because some cases do use that term, although it's right that other cases have used the term fairer allocation. Now, Sarah, it seems to me that there are at least two issues to which your approach gives rise in practice, and I'm not sure that the cases have yet definitively dealt with either issue. The first is where the burden lies and precisely what each party has to prove when it comes to fair allocation of value. What I hear you say is that the company needs to explain to the court why it would be commercially reasonable for the dissenting creditors to agree to the plan because the plan is fair. Now, that to me sounds rather like a modified form of the rationality test. However, to my mind, this tends to go back to the point about process. If the company can show that it has engaged or negotiated in good faith with creditors, then the company is going to be in a stronger position to say that the dissenting creditors should in fact have to demonstrate why they say, for their part, that the plan is not fair and that there is a different plan or a fairer plan. I also don't think that the burden lies solely on the company. It seems to me that the dissenting creditors need to demonstrate both that the plan is not fair and that a different allocation of value would have been possible and is fairer. To my mind, the cases so far have addressed this in fairly loose terms, as I say, whether there is a fairer plan or a different plan, which I think might tend to overlook the fact that the dissenting creditors must first show that the plan before the court is not fair. But I'm not sure I entirely agree that the company needs to show that it would be reasonable or rational for dissenting creditors to agree to the plan. That, to my mind, might put it, if I may say, too high, because there will be cases where the dissenting creditors are so deeply out of the money that a very low return to them under the plan might be fair and justifiable. So I think I might describe it in very slightly different terms. And this way, whether the allocation of value is fair and whether it would be commercially unreasonable for the dissenting creditors to hold out for more. This probably, I will confess, comes to the same in substance. But what I think we can't say is that a landlord receiving, say, 120% of what is a very low prescribed part in administration should be criticised for not voting in favour of the plan. The second issue is the practical question of how much, and is there any generally applicable framework for determining this? Now, we've seen fair allocation of value demonstrated in a number of different ways in the cases, but this has, of course, been inherently fact sensitive. In Hong Kong Air and in McDermott, different mechanisms were used to enable a contingent participation in the future profits or performance of the company. And so it was more straightforward to demonstrate that the allocation of value was fair. Then in Prezzo, where the facts were arguably much simpler, the company showed that the senior creditors were primarily benefiting from the cost saving of a plan over an administration. And so the amount of the cost saving or value to senior creditors under the plan was given to HMRC and accepted by the court as fair. And then in several of the landlord restructurings, we know that a 20% uplift on the return in insolvency has been accepted by the courts. But beyond this, I'm not sure we're really yet at a point where any generally applicable metrics have been more widely applied. There is a third and I would say huge point which you raise, which is whether the courts have been right to take such a hardline approach to out-of-the-money creditors and to proceed on the basis that where the relevant alternative is a formal insolvency, out-of-the-money creditors have no entitlement to share in the benefits created by the plan. And now I was on the losing side of that argument in Virgin Active and on the winning side in several of the subsequent cases, so I'm certainly not going to express a view on it here. But one thing I would say is that where the out-of-the-money creditors are complaining about the allocation of the equity to shareholders, there certainly are observations in both the Court of Appeals decision in Adler and in McDermott, which, as I read them, suggests that the point is certainly not closed. But what I would say is simply this. What I hear you to be saying, Sarah, is that in effect, whether or not you were dealing with in-the-money creditors or out-of-the-money creditors, in all cases, the question whether the assenting creditors are getting too much value has to be answered by looking at what they would be prepared to give to the dissenting creditors in order to enjoy the benefits of the plan as opposed to the alternative. So in other words, what value is it fair to give to assenting creditors over and above what they would get in the alternative? Recognizing that this is being made possible as a result of the compromise borne by the dissenting creditors. And I think I would agree with that.
Sarah, you started off by talking about the jurisdictional test of compromise or arrangement. So how does bargaining fit into the regime as a whole?
Thank you, Hussein. And before I touch on that, actually, I should just say that I really like Georgina's unreasonable formulation. Listeners might be aware, if they've looked at it, that in my published work at the moment, I did use the concept of rationality. And actually, in the work that I'm producing at the moment, I've dropped that because I agree, if what I'm going to get is an extremely low amount, then it's perfectly rational to roll the dice and hold out and see if I can get a lot more. So I think that rationality is not the right concept here. And I like the unreasonable formulation. I think that works well. So another assumption that I'd made in my earlier work that I've sort of come to view as incorrect is that, in common, I think, with lots of other commentators, I started off thinking that where the company claimed that the relevant alternative was an insolvent sale of the business or of the assets, and where the dissenting class was no worse off under the plan than that would be in that event, then the question of whether the allocation of the benefits under the plan is fair goes solely to discretion and not to jurisdiction. But in my current academic work, I've really paused on this, and I'm wondering whether that's correct or whether the allocation of the benefits under the plan might also be relevant to jurisdiction as well as discretion. So let me explain why. If the allocation of benefits under the plan isn't fair or perhaps commercially reasonable, whichever formulation we want to use, then we would expect the assenting classes to be willing to share a greater proportion of the benefits under the plan than they're currently offering if they were forced to do so. Now, it seems to me that if that's right, then in those scenarios, the relevant alternative is not an insolvent sale at all, but rather a new plan. And we've seen this in the scheme of arrangement cases, where the company has claimed that if the scheme were not sanctioned, the company will be placed into insolvency. Although what actually happened is where the court denied sanction, the company came back with a different plan. So we saw that, for example, in Amigo. We're also now seeing this in a Part 26A context. In the McDermott case, albeit as a result of the Dutch process, not the English process, but nonetheless, in the McDermott case, we saw the company effectively conceding a better offer. And so for me, there's a question mark about the situation in which the judge asks the company to explain why the allocation of benefits is commercially reasonable in seeking to understand whether the company has correctly identified the relevant alternative. So the third issue I wanted to raise is whether the court needs to ask the plan company to engage with the question of whether the allocation of the benefits under the plan is fair, in order to determine whether the company has correctly identified the relevant alternative at all, and therefore whether the court can be comfortable that the dissenting class is no worse off than it would be in the event of the relevant alternative. Now, Georgina, I don't know what you're going to make of that.
Well, Sarah, you certainly raise a very interesting point. And it's right that when you first suggested to me that allocation of value is relevant to jurisdiction, I thought it sounded rather radical. I think the two points still need to be viewed as distinct, but I can certainly see how, depending on the facts and nature of any challenge, exactly the same points might well arise. So when deciding whether the statutory precondition of the no worse off test is met, the company has, in most of the cases, supported its position on the relevant alternative by showing that no different or alternative plan would be available or viable. And the apex of this was aggregate. But I tend to think that this has to be approached in a measured way. The company should not, I think, for example, have to show that it has explored all possible permutations of different deals before concluding that the plan is the only deal on the table. The time pressures involved in most cases would simply make this unrealistic. So I think the question has to be whether there is an alternative which the assenting creditors should reasonably accept, rather than the open or wider question of whether there are alternatives out there that they would, if they were forced to do so, accept. Sarah, I guess you might therefore say this underscores your thesis that bargaining underpins the Part 26A regime as a whole.
I think that's right, Georgina. I am arguing that Part 26A is designed to incentivize bargaining against the threat of a cross-class cramdown. What it doesn't do, though, is provide a framework within which the parties can bargain. And that really stands in contrast with Chapter 11. So as others have pointed out, a company can petition for a Chapter 11, engage the automatic stay, raise debtor in possession financing, and negotiate. Part 26A, on the other hand, is intended to implement the best deal that the assenting classes are willing to offer, provided it's a commercially reasonable deal that the dissenting class is unreasonably refusing. If the debtor wishes to generate a more robust bargaining environment, then it would need to turn to other tools like administration or the Part A1 moratorium. And we certainly don't have time for this today, but there are serious limitations with both of those tools. So really, the final issue I wanted to raise for us today is whether we need a more robust bargaining environment or whether we think the existing toolbox is sufficient. What do you think, Georgina?
I certainly agree that time pressure and the absence of an automatic stay is an issue. There will be cases in financial restructurings where the scheduled maturity dates are foreseeable, and so a period of negotiation could be said to be accommodated sufficiently in advance, provided that creditors engage constructively. But there are going to be other cases where external factors are simply outside the party's control and have led to the need for the restructuring. So, for example, a sharp fall in oil prices, which causes revenues to drop sharply. And there simply may not be enough time prior to launching a plan to negotiate. So ultimately, I think these are factors which the court would have to take into account when assessing the extent of bargaining that has taken place and its impact on arguments that the plan is consequently unfair. Of course, we also know that negotiations will often continue once a plan has been launched. And McDermott was a clear illustration of this, although the outcome was impacted by the approach in the parallel Dutch WOA and the role of the restructuring expert. But without the automatic stay, as in Chapter 11, and without the statutory intervention of an independent expert, as they have under the WOA, I think there are obvious practical challenges to this under Part 26A.
Lots of food for thought here. To sum up, Sarah, what do you think the most difficult questions you have raised will be for the courts?
Well, goodness me, Hussein, we have raised some really rather difficult questions. So trying to pull them together, I think we've questioned whether the court should entertain plans where there is no evidence of trying to bargain for a compromise or arrangement. So Georgina makes the completely valid point that in some cases that will simply not have been possible. But in the ordinary course, should the court entertain plans in those circumstances? Should the court abandon the practice of allowing plan companies simply to rely on the fact that the dissenting class would be out of the money in the event of an insolvent sale of the business or assets, and instead require the plan company to explain why the allocation of plans benefits under the plan, and here I'm going to adopt our discussion term, is reasonable? Should the court require the plan company to explain why the allocation of benefits under the plan is reasonable for the purposes of assessing whether the company has satisfied the court what the relevant alternative is, and that the dissenting class is no worse off than they would be in that event? And should the dissenting class be required to explain why they think the allocation of the benefits under the plan is unfair or unreasonable for the same purpose? Or is this question only ever relevant to discretion? And then finally, should we consider the ability to negotiate once a plan has been launched? Or is it the case that all negotiations have to have happened before that point, and the company must just use one of the other tools if they need to reinforce the bargaining environment?
They're all really fascinating questions, Sarah. We will, of course, keep a close eye on how this area of law evolves, but that's, I'm afraid, all we've got time for today. Georgina, Sarah, thank you both for sharing your views with us. And to our audience, thank you for listening to DebtWired today. You can, as always, download or listen to more episodes of DebtWired on Apple and Spotify.